You're listening to iFaith Message 78, which I'm calling Faith by Numbers. Last time we were in the beginning of 2 Samuel, and we looked at David's funeral song for Saul and his son Jonathan. Today we're going to the very end of the book. And 2 Samuel doesn't end with the death of David. Interestingly, David is in 40 chapters in 1 and 2 Samuel. But he doesn't die until 1 Kings, where we'll be next. So we're at the end. It's near the end of his life. It's quite a scene as we join 2 Samuel chapter 24. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go count the people of Israel and Judah." So the king said to Joab and the commanders of the army who are with him, "Go through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and take a census of the people, so I may know how many there are." But Joab said to the king, "May the Lord your God increase the number of the people a hundredfold, while the eyes of my king the Lord can still see it. But why does my lord the king want to do this?" But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. This is a passage on David's ill-fated census. And it's not a good idea. Even Joab, the commander of the army, himself not a particularly spiritual person, as we see, we know a lot about him. Even he says, "David, don't do it." But he overrules him. Now, why would David want to count the people? Well, this is a military census. The purpose is to know how strong the fighting force is. How solid are we in our expectation to remain firm amidst our enemies? How can we control the economic corridors? How can we do what's best for our nation? I'm sure there are all kinds of reasons. Usually the census would be for military purposes, but it would also enable them to have an estimate of tax because they're going house to house. And there's a third thing that I'm not sure David did this, but in Solomon's time and after that, there was forced labor. It was a draft, not quite a military draft, but men were drafted to work a period of months, forced labor. Well, that's the introduction here. Joab says, "Don't do it." David overrules him, and they do that. And then next we read about how they go on a circuit around Israel. And it says, when they had gone through all the land, they came back to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. Joab reported to the king the number of those who had been recorded. In Israel, there were 800,000 soldiers able to draw the sword, and those of Judah were 500,000. So Joab, the one who said, "I don't want to do this," he's in charge because he's the commander of this military census, and he goes around the country. Now, a moment ago, I called it Israel. That's correct. But Israel has is also the northern part of the land. So from the perspective of after the division, that is two generations later, Israel is split into two. So you have Judah in the south, Israel in the north. So from that perspective, we see 800,000 here, 500,000 there. And by the way, when it says 1,000, we're not clear if that's an actual number or if those are military units, because that word elef in Hebrew means 1,000. More often, it simply means a clan or a group of people. At any rate, it seems like there were plenty of people able to fight. Okay, so this is like the book of Numbers, which has two military censuses in the beginning and the end. So David wants to have his own. But afterwards, David was stricken to the heart because he had numbered the people. David said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, I pray you, take away the guilt of your servant, for I have done very foolishly." When David rose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, "Go and say to David, thus says the Lord, 3 things I offer you, choose one of them, and I will do it." So David is realizing this was not a good decision for various reasons. And it seems that he may have figured this out on his own, or maybe he had a bad conscience after rejecting Joab's advice. And remember, the census is taking a long time. Even though Israel is a small country, still, any census is a big task. And it takes the better part of a year. And so God sends David Gad. Gad is his the prophet who will speak the truth to him, like Nathan, who we read about earlier. Gad came to David and told him, he asked him, "Shall 3 years of famine come to you on your land? Or will you flee for 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land?" That is plague. "Now consider and decide what answer I shall return to the one who sent me." Then David said to Gad, "I am in great distress. Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but let me not fall into human hands." Now, David realizes he's made the mistake, and he's given an option. 3 days of this, or 3 months of this, or 3 years of that. Presumably, the effect of these options would be similar. I don't think he's saying, "I'm choosing the lightest one." Presumably, the damage is done. I mean, this is going to happen now. There's an impact when a leader makes a poor choice. But David says, "I'd rather fall into the hand of the Lord. Let's go for 3 days." But by being required to choose one of those options, David he's really reminded, this is you. You caused this. So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel from that morning until the appointed time. 70,000 of the people died, from Dan, way up in the north, to Beersheba, way in the south. But when the angel stretched out his hand towards Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented concerning the evil and said to the angel who was bringing destruction among the people, "It is enough. Now stay your hand." The angel of the Lord was then by the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. When David saw the angel who was destroying the people, he said to the Lord, "I alone have sinned. I alone have done wickedly, but these are sheep. What have they done? Let your hand, I pray, be against me and against my father's house." The plague comes to an end just short, just before Jerusalem. Jerusalem, which David has captured and has become the capital, is spared. Jerusalem is spared. But if you didn't live in Jerusalem, just think how many people were affected by this. Now, in the books of Kings, as we'll see, Jerusalem is miraculously delivered in the time of Hezekiah. That's more than 2.5 centuries later. But in the time of Zedekiah, about 1.5 centuries after that, Jerusalem is not delivered. So in 2 Kings 19, it's delivered just like it is here. 2 Kings 25, it's destroyed, just as the Romans would destroy it again about 600 years later or more. I'm impressed with David because David admits his fault and he accepts, since he is the responsible one, he's the one who decided this, who pushed this. He accepts whatever punishment or suffering he must endure as a result. He's not making excuses. He's listening. He's so different to Saul. Saul got input that he rejected, and when he should have sought input, he did not seek it. David seeks input, and normally he responds very humbly when he receives it. Now, what's important here, there was an unfamiliar term, perhaps, Arunah the Jebusite. Well, the Jebusites are the Canaanite people who controlled Jerusalem. Joshua and later generations could not conquer Jerusalem. The Jebusites were there. I think Melchizedek was a Jebusite, that godly man we read about in Genesis 14 and Psalm 110. But thanks to Joab, thanks to the military, they figured out an ingenious way into the city. But it seems that they didn't destroy all the Jebusites. Again, this is you may get the impression that the Canaanites were wiped out, but they were mainly pushed out, and many actually stayed. At any rate, we have the Jebusite, Arunah, and he has land, basically, which he will sell to David, and David will offer a proper sacrifice now that the plague has ended. On that very spot, in the time of Solomon, David's son, the temple will be built. This is on Mount Moriah. This is where Abraham was told to sacrifice his son Isaac, Genesis 22. This is the site of the temple, and of course, very close by is where Jesus himself was crucified. It's the place of sacrifice. Two main accomplishments of David. One, he unified all the tribes, the 12 tribes who were the 12 sons of Jacob, which we call Israel. He unified them. The second accomplishment was capturing Jerusalem, making that the capital, making that the place where the temple would be built. And this is, again, huge importance, political and emotional and religious significance to the Jewish people. Well, let's talk about application before I let you go. I have a few thoughts for you. One, this thing about numbers. There was a time in my life as a minister where I love mathematics and I like to measure things. I went way overboard. Many of my friends did as well. Counting how much money is being contributed to the church, or how are we doing on this goal, or how many people are becoming Christians? I mean, these are valid questions, but monitoring and measuring, and let's just be honest, obsessing, that's not the right thing to do. It's not faithful. Some people justify an obsession with numbers flippantly. Well, there's a whole book in the Bible called Numbers. Ha ha. Okay. In Numbers, they're only counting men aged 20 to 50. It's only done twice, and these are military censuses. The early church didn't do this. Well, they did roughly keep track of the number of men in two instances. Acts 4, where we're told 5,000 males, because normally in that culture they count the men who would be the family heads, or then, and of course also in Acts 2, where about 3,000 men are baptized, who knows how many women. But good luck finding other passages in the New Testament that give you a solid number to fasten on. Acts 16:5, I suppose, speaks of the church is growing daily, whatever that means. Since we don't know the base number, we don't know the percentage. I don't really think they kept track. And there could be more harm done in keeping track than in not keeping track. Now, look, I understand. If you own a building and you have to pay for it, or if you're trying to organize an event and you need to know how many people are coming, it is smart to know. It's good to have at least an approximate idea. But the problem is the obsession, putting our confidence in numbers and the system. And that's what David did. That's what David did. I realized something was wrong in the churches where I was working on staff. In the late 90s, I wrote a paper called Statistics and Church Growth. And I began with this very passage, how we're not doing the right thing. We're too focused on the numbers. And this is backwards. That's the result. That's the fruit. We need to focus on the root. Let's plant seeds. It's more organic. We're being too much like a corporation, you know, with all these metrics. So what does this mean for us? Well, counting money, I guess it's good to help know how much you have, but you don't want to be a greedy man or woman who's counting all your money. And if you are in a leadership position in a company, it could even be a church, looking good financially doesn't always tell the whole story. For church leaders, counting members, counting conversions, let's rejoice in every single one. But let's not put our hope there, relying on our own resources, relying on our own strength. I think that's what's going on here. David messed up. He repented. Even though he repented, he hurt a lot of people. And that's the way it is when leaders make mistakes. And that's why it's so important for a leader to accept input, to welcome feedback, and to listen to God and listen to godly people. Oh, I find that a very exciting and challenging chapter. Next time, we'll be in 1 Kings. Thanks for listening.